Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A bipartisan group of police chiefs, mayors, and state lawmakers gathered last week in support of statewide gun reform. State Senator Peggy Lehner was among them. The Kettering Republican has changed her tack since the August 4 shooting in a popular entertainment district in downtown Dayton that left 9 dead. Lehner opened with an apology for her silence on gun reform.
I am indeed honored to be here with you today, and I apologize for taking so long to get here. I have supported the things that you have been doing for a long time, but I've been way too quiet about it.
It's our weekly reporter roundtable. With us, Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Jackie Borchardt, Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And we're double teaming it from the Cincinnati Enquirer today. Jesse Ballmer of the state is a state government reporter. Welcome.
Yeah, we got the dream team here
yeah,
today.
Yeah, I guess so.
Team JB.
You know? Wow.
You're so lucky, Andy.
Yeah.
I'm sure this is a scheduling glitch on my part. A bipartisan group of Ohio mayors, chiefs of police, state lawmakers, does it make any difference, Jesse Ballmer?
Well, I think this is the kind of pressure that those who support gun control need to keep up on state lawmakers. And I think seeing people like Senator Peggy Lehner, the Republican from Kettering, get on board with some of this, I think she makes arguments as a person who's been anti-abortion and anti-death penalty. She's been kind of the pro-life legislator her entire career and kind of making that argument to other pro-life legislators, other Republicans, I think is a tactic that hasn't been taken previously. So I think that helps. But they're also facing a very large hill in the Ohio legislature where it's controlled by Republicans, many of whom take their Second Amendment rights very seriously and are much more willing to kind of tweak the current system than support any kind of systematic overhaul.
Was she the bipartisan part of the bipartisan group, Andy Chow? Were there other Republicans amid?
There are other Republicans in this coalition, especially when it comes to the Mayor's Alliance. I was able to moderate a Columbus Metropolitan Club forum a couple weeks ago with three mayors, two of which were Republican mayors who are calling for this change, the mayor in Findlay and the mayor in Lancaster. And so what we're seeing now is there are more Republicans coming to the table to call for change. And I think what this also speaks to is just how moderate these changes are perceived by Republicans. So it's not asking for a huge swing of the bat. It's asking for these smaller changes that even Republicans want. So what we call the red flag law or the safety protection order, which expands the ability of courts to confiscate guns from somebody deemed as dangerous, and expanded background checks, which we see over and over again in polls that 90% of Ohioans want to see expanded background checks where it's required to have a background check even on personal transfers. So, yes, when we talk about a bipartisan group, there are several Republicans in the mix calling for this change.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We're talking about efforts by a bipartisan group of mayors and chiefs of police and lawmakers to address gun control legislation in the Ohio General Assembly. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So then, Jackie Borchardt, 90% of Ohioans support background checks. Why isn't it a done deal already then?
Well, I think there are, you know, I think this is one of those things where the support is high enough that eventually the legislature will feel pressure to do something on that topic. We saw that like with medical marijuana. We've seen it with
that was a ballot issue, though.
Right. But the public polling was over.
Same,
it was at
yeah.
the same mark. It was at 90%. You know, this legislature for the past, as long as I've been here, for the past 8 years, has been moving in the direction of expanding gun rights and expanding access to firearms. And really anything that has tried to move it the other direction has gone absolutely nowhere. I think that on the background check issue, I think there is a concern from the pro-gun rights side of things that in order to do, if you record every sale, it'll create some sort of a gun registry, and that, you know, infringes on the rights of lawful gun owners. There's also opposition to requiring it for every personal transfer or personal sale. If you're, you know, selling a rifle to your neighbor, right now you can do that neighbor to neighbor. If you were to require a background check, you would have to find a federally licensed firearms dealer to conduct that transaction. There would obviously be a fee involved in that. So those are kind of the arguments opposing it. And I think just generally getting any sort of change that would swing kind of the direction of things the other way is extremely difficult. And, you know, we were talking about Senator Peggy Lehner just a few minutes ago, and actually last December when there was a package of gun policy changes, she did stand up and she voted against it. And she said the reason she was voting against it is because of that, because they have not done anything to address gun violence, and every gun-related measure they have passed has been on the side of the gun owner.
And I think what we've seen a lot of the times when we do see an issue that polls so highly among Ohioans yet doesn't really move in the Ohio House and Senate, I think you have to ask yourself, if you were to ask that same group of people, 90% who want expanded background checks, if you were to ask them that if a candidate fell one way or another on that issue, would this issue, background checks, determine who they voted for? And so, yes, 90% of people might want expanded background checks, but it might not be the big deciding factor for who they end up voting for when they send a legislator to the Ohio House and Senate.
And that was a topic that actually Senator Lehner brought up last week. She said, you know, money might be one factor why Republicans vote for pro-Second Amendment proposals from the NRA, but really the more powerful message they're receiving is every time they vote for something that expands gun rights, they are getting votes. Like, there are people who are going out to vote for that issue alone. And until there are an equal number or more people who are willing to vote on the issue of gun control, there's really not the pressure to avoid a Republican primary challenger from the right or something like that. And so really it's those people who are willing to come out and vote consistently on the issue of guns that are keeping those people voting in this direction.
Yeah. And if you look at rural districts, you know, even the issue of expanded background checks is even big among rural districts. But how many of those regions that are considered heavily Republican or heavily conservative, how many of those voters would vote for maybe a Democratic candidate just because of this issue? I think it's unlikely.
Local control is another issue that's popped up again regarding this. There are some mayors reaching out, the Ohio Municipal League. I mean, this has been an ongoing issue. There's been an erosion of local control in a state that touts itself as a local control state, that meaning that local political subdivisions can make their decisions and decide for themselves. And back in the day, a city like Columbus, for instance, had restrictions on where you could carry guns, public parks, that kind of a thing. And the Ohio General Assembly put the kibosh on that. Is there any chance, especially considering the fact that there are Republican mayors in this group of people, Jackie Borchardt, that the local control issue is going to get some traction?
So this is actually one that I think probably has the least likely chance of passing, simply because the legislature just as recently as last session, you know, tightened those up even more. And it's being challenged in court. But they, you know, went the extra 9 yards and and really locked down any ability for local entities to set any further restrictions than on the state level. And, you know, the reasoning behind that is that if every community has, it's like, look at Columbus. If Columbus has one set of rules and Hilliard has another set of rules and Dublin has another set of rules, how does a gun owner keep all of those different rules separate? How are they supposed to know? So there is, you know,
I understand that logic. I think everybody understands that
logic.
But
I think
why have any local laws then? That's what I guess I'm wondering.
Well, it's in our Constitution. So it makes it extremely difficult. We have home rule is established in the Ohio Constitution.
Right.
And this is one of many instances where the legislature, you know, they like local control until they don't, until the locals are doing something that they disagree with. And then they swoop in and try to, narrowly change the law so that they're not conflicting with that home rule provision in the Constitution. And they've done it on several things. They've done it on, pet store sales. They've done it on right now they're talking about banning plastic bags. Mm-hmm.
Drilling, oil and gas drilling, right. And injection well drilling.
That's right, fracking, right.
Right. So, I mean, like I said, this one's already the most recent effort to kind of tighten those is already in court. And the other side's argument, I think, is valid as well, which is, a community like Columbus is very different from a community like Lancaster or, even going further out, if you go down to Athens or Nelsonville. I mean, they're very different communities with different problems, different needs. And if they want to try something different to address those problems, that's where the mayors are upset and concerned, because they feel like they know their communities well. They want to make a decision, and they their hands are tied.
The local control issue is really big among mayors, like Jackie said, especially when it comes to cities who want to try to find ways for they themselves to make their community members safe or feel safe. And so, again, the group of mayors of the top, I think, 30 biggest cities in Ohio, they all kind of come to the same agreement here that there should be some sense of local control. And when it comes to the Republican mayors in that group, they do sort of side with what Jackie mentioned was sort of the argument against local control when it comes to reciprocity. And, if one city allows concealed carry and then the next door city does it, and then the Republican mayors especially, they are also against this patchwork of policies around the state. But this larger group of mayors also says there's got to be some wiggle room when it comes to other things like zoning for manufacturing. So they say a city should be able to be allowed to ban the manufacturing of guns in their city if they don't want a company to manufacture firearms or to manufacture bump
stocks.
And that
would be – is affected by this –
And apparently
they
see that whatever the state has created when it comes to local control, when it comes to gun policies, they see it as the state taking control away.
Including shooting ranges and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that can you have, local zoning ordinances prohibiting having a shooting range within X number of feet of a school, that kind of a thing, or not?
I'll be honest, I haven't heard about that issue as much. But I heard about manufacturing. So when it comes to creating a product, there are cities that want to ban the creation of products. And they say that doesn't have to do with an Ohio citizen traveling from one to another, personal rights. They say that's more of being able to have a say in what kind of businesses go up in their communities.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. And from the Cincinnati Inquirer, Columbus Bureau, Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt, and State Government Reporter Jesse Ballmert. We just finished talking about gun control in the state of Ohio and where it's headed, which is right now kind of nowhere. And now I want to talk about whether the Chinese are coming or not. Mm. I mean, are they coming for us? Jesse Ballmert, what do you think?
No, okay. They're not coming for us. But if you've read some literature or seen some ads recently, you might think that they are. And that's because advertisements from some groups that are supportive of the changes made in House Bill 6, which would bring in money for two nuclear plants in northern Ohio and a handful of solar plants, and also secure money for two coal plants. They would like that to take effect. And there's an effort, a referendum effort, that is on a pretty tight timeline that wants to block that. And so these groups are saying, you know, don't help these people get the referendum on the ballot. Don't give them your signature. Don't give them your information, because they might give it to the Chinese.
Yeah, they're fear mongering. They're sending out, they're pumping millions and millions of dollars around the state to get ads out there, to get flyers out there, to scare people into signing a petition, which is, you know, a democracy in action is to for citizens to be able to put an issue on the ballot. And so good government groups, voter rights groups are really upset about this, the action being taken by Ohioans for energy security, which we don't know who's funding them. We don't know if First Energy Solutions or First Energy Corporation is funding them, because it's a dark money organization. But they're certainly echoing the agenda of those two companies. And it's they're trying to get the message out there and trying to scare people into not signing this petition. Now, what is true about this? These statements.
What's the kernel
nothing.
Of truth?
Well, we don't really. Yeah, what's the kernel of truth? That's a good question.
First, so, is there any truth?
All right, yeah. there's 2 points
Jackie
here.
Borger.
The first is they're linking this campaign to overturn the law as being run by the Chinese or supported by the Chinese, and the link that they point to is that a Chinese state government run bank in China is one of like a dozen or so lenders to some natural gas fired plants in Ohio, some new plants. And of course, there are other banks, but, you know, like French bank and a Swiss bank. But the ad is not about those.
Nobody's saying the Australians are coming
right.
for you.
What are they going to get?
But it's a loan. It's they're financing the loan. They as far as we can tell from things that we have looked at, they're not equity partners in these projects. They're financing a loan,
which they do a gazillion times a day all over the United States.
Right. And like I said, involves banks from around the world. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, on the other side of things, I should say, is that First Energy Corporation, which is the parent company of First Energy Solutions, which operates the power plants, has also received financing from the exact same bank in China. So, you know, their basic line is that supporter or opponents of this law are being backed by its Chinese loans when, you know, supporters of the law are also being backed by Chinese loans. So that's where the China argument is coming from. And then the second point about don't let the Chinese get your personal information. The information that you give when you sign a petition is what should match the information that you also give the Board of Elections, which is public information.
Like that's anybody, why we get so much stuff in the mail, because somebody has access.
Anybody, I can go, you can go, any of your listeners can request that information. Mm-hmm. It's public information.
That's how the group was able to send the mailers in the first place.
Right.
So
they have
your information already.
So how, I mean, so there are legitimate arguments to debate about House Bill 6 and whether it is good for Ohio, and whether, you know, and that's like a conversation that we might be having if this makes the ballot. But this is a distraction.
Yeah. I mean, nuclear power makes up 15% of Ohio's grid. It's non-carbon emitting. There is other waste involved, but it's not carbon emitting. It employs about 2,000 people and even more when it comes to other like contract work. There's a lot of things to be said for why people might support nuclear power and support these subsidies. But none of those arguments are being reflected in the advertisements.
And this is to keep it from even getting on the ballot. They must have some data that shows them that this could work, because they're obviously spending a lot of money. These are fancy mailers, color.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible.
a lot
yeah,
of red.
The polling, they could have done polling that shows that a referendum has support. That's one thing. It's also, you know, looking ahead to next year, we have a presidential year. Things get a lot more expensive in a presidential year. All political activity does. So, you know, while they're spending a couple million dollars now on these ads and these flyers, that cost would be far greater next year. And also once it's on the ballot, you know, your stakes are a little higher. It's not only, you know, it could pass or not, where at this point, whatever they're spending, like if it doesn't, if it still makes the ballot, like they've got another shot to try to.
And you
got to
remember, again, we don't know who's funding these groups, but First Energy Solutions is bound to make $150 million a year through HB6. So whoever's fighting that cause right now, putting putting $3 to $10 million behind a campaign seems worth it if you're going to get $150 million on the back end every year.
What the thing is it did pass the Ohio General Assembly. House Bill 6 did. It's House Bill 6, right?
House Bill 6.
It passed the House, it passed the Senate, and the governor signed it into law with very little fanfare. I mean, it happened right away, very quickly.
Fastest I've ever seen it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, talk about grease lightning. So there's nobody, is there anybody from Ohio, you know, in Ohio government leadership that is standing up and saying that this is beyond the pale, this kind of campaign? Or is it just the media covering it at this point?
Not that I've seen. And I think they're supportive of the legislation. I don't know if they're supportive of these tactics, but that's obviously a valid question. But you even had Bob Poduchik, who is President Donald Trump's guy in Ohio, making calls on this. You had congressmen making calls on this. So this is a priority. And I think it's a priority for President Trump because it looks bad for a nuclear plant to be closing in 2020 in the middle of a presidential election. So it's important to have those jobs in place.
It really, like, you know, this could have saved, this had the potential to save between 2 to 5 power plants.
But it's unclear if they're saying the power plants would close if they didn't have it. But is that, do we know that? Absolutely. Or is that just a threat?
Well, they did file in federal bankruptcy court a plan to shut the plants down had they not received this extra funding. They are going bankrupt. They are still going through the bankruptcy process, and new investors will likely buy it at some point. So this new money is actually just making the plants looking more viable after the bankruptcy process.
But we don't know what amount they would need. Yeah, like this number, I don't think anybody ever found out exactly where that number came from, if that's exactly what they need, or it seems like it may be a little bit more because we've seen, you know, it may help their. They have a coal plant, right?
It's important to point out that while we were talking about $150 million going to the nuclear plants, First Energy Solutions announced that because of these extra subsidies, they were able to ensure that they're going to keep one of their coal plants open, which is something that didn't really come out during the committee hearing process. So, you know, putting money in one pot so you can move another pot to help the coal plant maybe. But yeah, so there are basically 3 plants, 2 nuclear, 1 coal from First Energy Solutions that the company says they can keep running through these subsidies.
And the timeline has always been a little squishy on when they need this money because they've been coming to Ohio lawmakers for years now saying, like, if we don't get it by this date, then we're going to have to close. And if we don't get it,
the finishing line.
And even if you recall earlier this year, they needed it by June 30th. Well, I guess we'll take it a few weeks later too, you know. Even these fees aren't actually going to take effect until 2021. So,
What was – you said they've been coming to the Ohio General Assembly for years asking for this. What was the magic of 2019?
Larry Householder is the Speaker of the House now, and I think that's what really got the ball moving. Also, this bill, HB6, the one we have in front of us now, which is law, it not only subsidizes nuclear and then ensures subsidies for coal, but it also rolls back renewable energy standards and eliminates energy efficiency mandates. So those two things, renewable and efficiency, these were requirements on utilities to invest in renewable energy and to achieve energy efficiency. Those were big tentpole issues for conservatives. They wanted to get rid of those mandates. They've been wanting to get rid of those for 8 years now, ever since they passed it, basically. And so that issue was included into this bill. And I think that brought a lot of conservatives on board who might not have been likely to pass what was seen as a bailout bill. But because it rolled back renewable energy, because it eliminated energy efficiency mandates, that brought a lot of people on board. Speaker Larry Householder has been a big proponent of those two issues of subsidizing nuclear and getting rid of the green energy standards for a long time now.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That was Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. And with us from the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jackie Borchardt and Jesse Balmert. What about this issue of watchers? They're being called harassers by the people gathering signatures. What's going on with that, Jesse?
Yeah, so this came to the concept of having people like watch the process of signature collection is not entirely new. I think it's really come to the forefront because there was this incident in Dublin at a library where there was a kind of altercation between the person who was collecting signatures and someone who was watching them. The person collecting signatures tried to take a picture of the person who was observing them, and then they got into a bit of a
scuffle.
Kerfuffle.
Someone slapped someone's phone out of their hand.
Yeah, slapped the phone out of the hand, and this resulted in criminal damaging charges. So I think people who weren't aware that people existed that were paid to watch people collect signatures and provide other information and kind of the opposing view even existed were kind of surprised that they did, and that it resulted in, you know, charges in Dublin, Ohio. So I think you're seeing a much more aggressive effort to both get it on the ballot and to keep it off the ballot than you have seen on other issues.
And if you watch the video, it's almost like these citizens are just running the gauntlet, where you have one person on one side handing them a flyer, you have one person on the other side handing a flyer, and they're just kind of these mm-hmm. everyday citizens are going through the middle, like wondering what to do. One person's trying to get them to sign the petition to put a referendum on the ballot. One person's trying to hand them a flyer that says, hey, don't give the Chinese government your information. Mm-hmm. So it is just kind of this back and forth where people are hearing both sides of the argument. But yeah, what we know, we see this a lot as reporters when we cover campaigns. There are these people known as trackers, where mm-hmm. a candidate will go out and then all of a sudden you kind of see somebody who's definitely not with that
video
campaign
recording it,
holding
yeah.
a camera up, mm-hmm. just following. And it's sort of
it's been going
along
on a long
lines.
Time.
Yeah. But that's but there's a lot of money going into this, which I think is important. Again, it's not only the ads on TV, but it's the flyers, but these people tracking them.
Have there been any complaints filed as far as these tactics with the flyers? The mailers and what they're alleging.
Well, there was the police report given.
Well,
there was the cease and desist. Yeah,
Ohio Citizen Action had sent a cease and desist letter asking them to take down the ads, and they replied back saying no. They have a First Amendment right for you know political speech,
say whatever
free
they want.
Speech, right? And in Ohio, you know, we had a law against. We had rules against lying and putting false information in advertisements, and that got struck down. Went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and that is no more. But even when that was in place, it was very hard to enforce.
Kind of a paper
the process.
Kind of a law.
Yeah, the process is you would make a complaint, and it would take several months for the Elections Commission to review it.
What was this a topic of conversation? Did any of you cover the demonstration last week on climate change down at the State House? Mm-hmm. Was this a topic of conversation down there?
It was one of the first things they mentioned.
Okay.
So there were to catch people up, there were hundreds of students and young people out at the West Plaza of the Ohio State House on Friday. It was the climate strike. It was a protest to call for action against climate change, led by young people with the message of, hey, we are the future. Please make decisions that are right for our environment. And then you could instantly see among this swarm of people, there were petitioners who were walking around getting people to sign the petition to put HB6 on the referendum. And then again, you know, one of the first speakers brought up HB6 and what their position is that it does too much harm to the green energy industry in Ohio. It does too much harm to policies that can help cut down on carbon emissions. I think if you were to ask the pro-nuclear bailout people, they would want to point out that nuclear is carbon free, but that wasn't part of the argument at the big rally on Friday.
Mm. Ohio, I know, is getting to be seen as kind of a conservative stronghold now. It's being viewed around the country. Is there a sense? I mean, it used to be a blue-collar Democratic, pretty safe Democratic state now. And there was questions in 2016 about whether it had kind of crossed the, I don't know, the Rubicon or whatever you want to call it, and changed colors from purple to red.
Yeah, I think if you look at most national lists, we're seen as kind of center right now. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Ohio's legislature is Republican. The governor, all of the most of the statewide elected officials, with the exception of Sherrod Brown and a couple Ohio Supreme Court justices, mm-hmm. are Republicans. They have super majorities in both the House and the Senate. So I think you, even looking at just our representation, it's easy to see that as Republican, it leans Republican at the very least. I don't think Donald Trump could have won the state by 8 percentage points mm-hmm. if we were, you know, deeply, deeply purple. I think there's arguments to be made that Ohio is still a swing state. And I mm-hmm. think what we're going to see in 2020 is that true? I think 2020 will be an excellent test of which direction Ohio is heading as far as its political makeup.
I definitely don't think it's a lock for Republicans, but I think it's much easier for a Republican to win the state. Whereas with the Democrats, and I think we saw this in last year's gubernatorial race, mm-hmm. I think Democrats are going back to the drawing board to figure out exactly what the game plan should be to win the state. I think there's been a lot of focus in the big cities, like here in Columbus, Cleveland, somewhat Cincinnati. But I think they need to try to figure out how they can regain Mahoning Valley and the Youngstown area.
Without the union piece of it, because that's been rendered pretty weakened.
It hasn't really moved the needle that much.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think the Democrats are the ones who are really trying to figure out how a statewide candidate could win this state. I think it has to be a very different, maybe compelling game plan, and then it has to be the right candidate too, because I think that we've seen that a lot in Ohio, where if you do have the right candidate, somebody like Sherrod Brown, who seems to consistently win, and he's a Democrat, you have all those factors in play.
What do you think?
Well, and I don't think either parties, I don't think the Democrats have written off Ohio,
right.
And it is just politically and strategically, it's a difficult state. It's an expensive state as far mm-hmm. as building a network of field workers, of campaigning, putting resources into advertising. You know, we have several major media markets, mm-hmm. which is kind of rare for a state our size.
You mean as population?
Yeah,
we
our
have
population.
Seven kind
yeah,
of major
yeah,
media
we do. And so it's not. So in many ways, you know, we're like Michigan and Wisconsin, but in many ways we're not. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you could say like that Democrats have written off Ohio yet. We are having their debate here next month
mm-hmm. at
up in Westerville.
Yep.
And, the big push from Ohio Democratic Party Chairman David Pepper is that the suburbs are where they want to focus and where they think that they are picking up voters. Because look, you know, Ohio, our demographics are changing and have changed in the last 10 years. We're pretty far now from where we were the last time that our congressional and state house district maps were drawn. And things have certainly changed since then. So we're kind of at this point where we're kind of at the end of the life of those maps and kind of looking over to see what's going to happen in the next, you know, 4 years. So that changes things. That changes a lot of your strategy. Like Andy had mentioned, there was a lot of focus on cities, and the Democrats did actually pretty well in 2018. If you look at their raw numbers, they did great. I mean, they had vote totals were over 2 million, which historically speaking, they should have won. But the Republicans had way more.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the map, I mean, it was, not only Republicans were able to pick up more votes in those less urban areas, in exurbs and in more rural areas. And so whatever, you know, candidate and message the Democrats have, it has to make some inroads there to not lose as many votes in those areas as they did in, say, 2018, if you're going to win Ohio. And, maybe that's obviously a goal, but maybe it's just helpful to maybe put up the best fight you can, and maybe you still the Democrats still lose Ohio, but not by as much. And, kind of helping the other Midwestern states that are going to be seen as more maybe winnable next year, your Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania.
We're going to take a quick break. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, and double teaming it from the Cincinnati Enquirer Columbus Bureau, Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt, and state government reporter Jesse Balmer. So, Kellyanne Conway was senior advisor to President Donald Trump, was the keynote at big Ohio GOP dinner on Saturday. She said, get more female candidates. That's what she told the Republicans.
Yeah. So she had a kind of sit down chat with Jane Timken, who is the first female leader of the Ohio Republican Party. And so that was Jane Timken's first question, was how do we get more women involved in politics? And Conway's response was that I think often women wait to be asked to get involved in politics and have a lot of kind of analysis of what they need to do to get into politics. Whereas she said, you know, guys, you just wake up in the mirror and you see a senator. So I think that's certainly been a message that both Democrats and Republicans have made as far as getting more women involved in politics. She also spoke about the 2016 campaign. Obviously, Conway was the first woman campaign manager of a successful presidential campaign, and just her involvement in that. She also talked about Democrats and how she doesn't recognize the Democratic Party, you know, saying that they value diversity and women in leadership, and yet some of their frontrunners are white men. So she kind of ran the gamut of topics. Of course, she was the presidential campaign manager for a white man. So
yeah.
There
and
you go.
She's a survivor in an administration that is it's like shifting sands every single day.
You know, that's a common theme that we've been hearing lately is empowering women to rise through the ranks and go for positions that they might think that they're not qualified for. And we're seeing more and more studies that come out lately that talk about who feels qualified for what. So there are several researchers and studies that say that men will apply for a job if they think that they've met, I think, 60% of the qualifications, where women will apply for a job if they meet much higher than that, 85 to 90% of the qualifications.
They feel more of an obligation to be qualified for their job.
Right. And so it's basically like...
Well, when you put it that way.
or they might... And so, for example, there's a new book out called Represent. It's the Woman's Guide to Running for Office. It's written by Kate Black. And
I'm interviewing her later this week.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. And so... And I've actually read the book. It's really interesting. It's really cool.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting.
And it really gets into... Why especially women may not run for office or go for that position or go for that title that they do deserve. I'm really not the one who should be talking about this, but it's just...
But you read the book, Andy. You read the book.
Everybody stay quiet while I talk about this a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think another...
I don't mind being Andy Splained. It's fine.
I think another topic that I kind of dove into this was some women leaders when we were coming up on the centennial of the suffrage movement, and I think just seeing women in leadership positions, having Amelia Sykes being the minority leader for the Democrats in the House, seeing a strong Black woman being in that position of power. Obviously, there are too few people in those positions right now, but having those examples makes it a little bit easier for the next person to see themselves in that role as well.
Hmm.
Yeah. You know, mentorship is a big part of that. Like, you know, kind of the idea of carrying as you climb is bringing people up with you. And that gets to something that Kellyanne Conway also said on Saturday night. Like, there's no such thing as an old girls club. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there can be now, you know, going forward, you have situations or environments where women feel that they can, you know, help other women. It's not I think sometimes in the past it's been seen as maybe threatening to your own career to help another woman, because it's, you know, there was kind of this feeling that if you had achieved some sort of rank that, you know, maybe there could only be so many, you know, kind of like a secret quota. There could only be so many women at your level. And so I think that has really faded away, and you see a lot more of that kind of informal mentorship and encouragement among women. And you see it especially, I think, in politics. And yeah, in the end numbers of things, it's not a huge improvement. But like when Jesse and I were talking with these women politicians in Ohio, all of them had said that, you know, they felt encouraged by someone who came before them. And there are ways for women to get more involved in politics, more now than there were before.
I think it's interesting when you read that book. It's a really fun book to read, for starters. But and we'll get into that more this week when I interview Kate Black. But all the different reasons why women go into politics, is it's so much more variety than the standard white male response would typically be. I'm sure there's lots of reasons why men get into politics, but with women, it has a lot more to do with personal experience, you know, fighting the man. You know?
Yeah, I think another issue that comes up is challenges fundraising, not necessarily because women are bad fundraisers, just because they don't have the established network that a lot of guys getting into politics
Women tend not to
have.
Give money. They tend, if they give money in politics, they tend to give what their spouse is giving or something like that. And that's starting to change too, right?
And I think you see organizations like the Matriots, like Emily's List has been around for a while on the Democratic side, but like Joanne Davidson's Leadership Institute.
Former Speaker of the House.
Speaker of the House, the only woman Speaker of the House so far, a point that I think she sees as disappointing, that there haven't been anyone.
She doesn't really like
her.
That's a fact about her still.
So
I think there's movements towards improving that, but just like the base of fundraising support isn't as strong.
And by the way, she became the Speaker of the House after many, many years of serving in the House, whereas now with term limits, it's a constantly changing array. And, you know, now we've got Larry Householder, who's already been Speaker of the House. He gets doubles. Let's talk about some issues that are popping up in the headlines a lot, and that one of it is the e-cigarettes, the vaping issue. Again, I mean, most of the deaths and illnesses that are caused by these e-cigarettes or these vaping devices they're not really sure what's causing it, but what the lawmakers here and across the country seem to be going right for the flavored cigarettes, and don't seem to be actually dealing with the problem with vaping in and of itself. It has to do more with the flavor. Are any of you guys covering that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it is interesting to see that's kind of been the instant reaction
like
to this vaping illness. Is to ban the flavors. I think, you know, public health advocates have been talking for years, or, you know, as soon as the flavored, you know, vaping liquid first came out, about how, you know, same thing like with cigarettes, that the flavors, when you have like candy flavors, it is attractive to children. And so that's been kind of, I think, around for a while. And I personally like to, I hope that these things are considered, maybe that the ban is considered separate from the vaping illness, because like you said, we don't know yet exactly what is causing this sudden lung disease that's very severe. It's caused, it's
big
led to eight
last week.
Big uptake, over 500 confirmed cases in, I think, 38 states. And there was an eighth confirmed death last week in Missouri's first death, and no death so far in Ohio. But we're up to, I think, 17 confirmed cases here. And there's not, you know, this has been going on for several weeks, and they still have not been able to pinpoint exactly what one or even two or three things are maybe responsible for this. And there's even some disagreement among experts about whether this is a really new onset thing or whether it's something that maybe has been happening quietly for a much longer time or maybe has been building up. But basically the trend in all of these cases is it involves some sort of vaping, whether that was with a nicotine vape, a THC infused vape. Mm-hmm. So that's it's unknown at this point. You know, the Department of Health did tell me last week that 90% of Ohio's cases involved an illegal THC vape product, and none of Ohio's legal medical marijuana products have the additives, the cutting agents, all the various things that officials in other states who have studied this more than Ohio have kind of singled out as possible causes.
My colleague Joe Ingles with Ohio Public Radio has been covering this a lot lately, and she's been talking with the Ohio health director several times. And so, like Jackie said, there's kind of two things going on here. One is this health crisis and trying to figure out what exactly is causing this uptick in illness and death. But then it has refocused policymakers, the governor being one of them, different legislators, into the issue of flavored e-cigarettes, which has been an issue for a while at the State House. Even before these illnesses have come up, there have been legislators who have been wanting to ban it. They say that there's a clear link between these products and trying to tailor them to kids, where they might taste like bubble gum or they might taste like Sour Patch Kids. Who are they trying to attract as consumers of those products? And legislators say that they're trying to attract kids.
Big investors in, I think, Juul, the big e-cigarette company, is, of course, tobacco companies.
Mm-hmm.
They have a vested interest in
And I don't think it's surprising that Governor DeWine has kind of latched onto this topic. He's been really, a lot of his policies have focused on children and improving their health and their well-being. We increased the purchase age for tobacco products in the budget. So, yeah, I think this is just like one more thing that he can look into to address smoking and children getting into that habit and addiction.
And of course, both of these things, the vaping illness and the issue of the flavored vape liquid, it also underlying this is this surge in youth vaping. I've seen several reports in the last couple of weeks about schools, even in Ohio, who are buying vapor detection monitors to put in like bathrooms and places in schools. You talk to educators in middle and high schools, and they will tell you that, you know, the kids are vaping and juuling all day because it's very discreet. It doesn't have the odor that smoke does. And so, you know, there's that public health concern as well that, you know, in the hands of children, that this can be very dangerous, both, you know, filled with nicotine or THC, or, you know, if they're not regulated or produced by a reputable manufacturer, who knows what's in them.
Hmm. We just have a few minutes left, but how are the vaping companies responding to these? Do we know?
The association that represents a lot of vaping companies in Ohio say that if they were to ban flavored e-cigs, that they would all go out of business. They say it's a huge part of their business are these flavored vaping. Not a lot of people would vape just without any
just to get
flavor
the
at all. Yeah. And so the huge selling point for vapes and for e-cigarettes is to have it flavored. It's like why hookah was such a big trend a couple of years ago is because there are flavors that go with it. And I think there's hundreds of these vaping stores around the state. I think 500.
So. Yeah, they've really popped up a lot in the strip malls, that kind of a thing.
And I think they're also really trying to distance themselves from the less regulated products that are being linked to the vaping illness.
Maybe the bootleg, that kind of thing.
Right, but the information on this has been really hard as someone who gathers information for a living. It's really hard to figure out exactly what the trend is.
Jackie Borchardt, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's Jackie Borchardt. She's Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer here in Columbus. And also with us is State House reporter Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Thanks to you as well.
Always good to be here.
And Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks, Ann.
Another Andy-splaining day. And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.